The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
To go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they are
hard. Four, three, two, one.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Monday afternoon California Time Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks very much for tuning in today. A good analytical program is about to start. Let me make a couple of quick announcements before we get underway. Our toll-free number, for those of you who would like to give us a call, is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners, so be patient. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. Don't give up. Don't hang up. Just wait, and we'll get to you really and truly, I mean it, as quickly as possible, although sometimes some of you may think it's eternity because you hang up and you quit. Don't quit. And the email, if those of you are listening at work or someplace where you can't really access a phone, it is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com, which is also our new website, thespaceshow.com. So please do visit it. Let us know what you think of it. So we have a new website newsletter. You'll see it in the middle of the homepage. But we also have upcoming events on the right sidebar menu. So check that out. That gives you a glimpse of what's in store for the week, and also the time of the show, California time, Pacific time, and the guest bio if you click on the highlighted part of the guest name. So that's a new feature. A lot of other new features on the Space Show website, including the blog, which is integrated into our archive program. So when you see a program on the right side menu in the upcoming show, if you click on that program, you can already start posting comments on the blog before the show starts, during the show starts, and certainly when the program is archived. And if you are posting comments on the blog during the show, I will get a copy of those comments, and I will treat them as email questions for the guest during the show. So that's another way you can communicate with us if you have a comment or a question for our guest. And that is available right now for this show. Again, just check it out on the right sidebar menu of thespaceshow.com. Do remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked, and we do encourage all of you to download and share our programs, although it's a lot easier to just send people that you think should be interested or are interested the URL of the show. We're using a different format for archiving our programs, so they're now about 20 to 25 megabytes in size, but that's still too big for email. So just sending the URL is fine, but if you do want to send somebody the actual show, go for it. There's just a couple of rules about doing that. One is don't do anything commercial with our program. Number two, don't edit our programs and put any cuts, clips, or edits up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. Our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of the spaceshow.com website pages, and also our parents' website pages, onegiantleapfoundation.org. Podcasting is through Andrew at gigadial.net. We're in iTunes and a host of other places. And Apple iPhone users, maybe 2% of you are reporting problems with our podcast since we switched over to the new website and the new file system and all of that. So we do want to hear from you if you're having a problem, but it's a really hard problem to troubleshoot, especially since Apple's podcast app problems, which are very similar to those of you that are reporting problems, is really horrible and it has problems that are extremely well documented on the internet, stemming from problems with their operating system, iOS 9. So, obviously, if your problem comes from the Apple app or iOS 9, there's not a thing we can do with it. But we are trying to track it down and help people that do have this problem. Again, it seems to be about 1% to 2% of Apple users, and most of them, this is really interesting, are outside the United States. Now, go figure that one out, right? The app I recommend that you use for iPhones, whether you're in the United States or outside, is called Overcast. It is a 5-star app. It is free for the download, and it is rated by The Verge and other services as the best iPhone app for iPhone usage for podcast. And it works flawlessly with our podcast, which makes me think this is an iOS 9 or Apple app problem. I've posted comments about this on the Space Show Announcement blog, which you can find on the homepage of our new website. And if you scroll down to the bottom of the announcement, I even put the Verge article, which talks about the Apple podcasting app and Overcast and rates Overcast for those of you that are interested in reading about this. But again, we do want to hear from you. So thank you for letting us know if you're one of those that are having a problem. We want to know about your problem and if there's a way that we can try to work with you to help you do it. Our podcasts are heard in iTunes and a host of other places. And if you want to know where or you have some suggestions of other places we should place our podcast, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Finally, before we jump into our program today and I introduce our guests, we do have sponsors that bring you our program, especially since we have our new website. So the first part of our program is brought to you by Orbital ATK, a global leader in aerospace and defense technology. Orbital ATK is a partner that you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. Another sponsor for part one of our program is the Integrated Space Plan, which is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail. Their website is thespaceplan, all one word, .com. They have discussions there, regular updates, and you can participate in exclusive interactive features. They also sell copies of the Integrated Space Plan as full-color posters in two sizes, so you can get one and hang it on the wall in your space office or where you have your space library or memorabilia. And again, I urge you to go visit thespaceplan.com, and those sponsors, plus our other sponsors, all have banners rotating across our homepage. Take some time to check them out. I know you all probably just glance over them and all of that, but we wouldn't be doing the space show if it were not for our sponsors. So give them the benefit of a doubt. They're interesting companies doing really interesting, unique things. So check out their banners, and thank you for listening to those messages. And today, Phil Smith is with us, and this, I believe, is his second space show appearance. He was last on way too long ago, many, many years ago. Phil has over 18 years of experience in the space industry, covering subjects like emerging space markets, space industry trends, space technologies, space policy, and the history of spaceflight. He works as a senior analyst for the TORI Group, and that's spelled T-A-U-R-I Group, a technological consulting firm based in the Washington, D.C. area. He previously worked for the Secure World Foundation, Futron, and SAIC after serving 8 years in the Air Force and the Air Force Reserve as a nuclear missile specialist and a bioenvironmental engineering tech, respectively. He also volunteers as a tour guide at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum and is a freelance artist. He earned his degree in political science from the University of Nebraska in Omaha and has a master's degree in space studies from the University of North Dakota. Phil, welcome back to the show. Nice to talk to you again. How are you?
Thanks, David. Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start in with your following or being aware of or noting space tourism. And I say that because Virgin Galactic displayed Spaceship Two a couple of days ago. It got a lot of press, both in the general public as well as in the space news. Still uncommitted about when they are going to resume Spaceship Two flights. Kind of a tongue twister for me today. Talk to us about how you view the suborbital space tourism industry, and is there any hope for an orbital space tourism industry?
Yeah, so for a question like that, it's really good for any kind of space industry question. It's good to have sense of context. We basically estimate that the global space industry, so the worldwide space industry, to include commercial revenue, revenue from companies like DirecTV, those sorts of things, all the way to government budgets, is about $324 billion. So that's a pretty significant chunk of change, and that was the value that we sort of figured out for 2015. In that number, is commercial human spaceflight as it stands now. And that is about, it's a little shy of 800 million is basically what we're talking about here. So it's actually a very tiny sliver of this larger $324 billion industry. In that sliver are a couple of things, a few things that further provide context. And orbital spaceflight is one of them. And when we're talking about orbital spaceflight, we're talking about things like we anticipate with the SpaceX Dragon, Crew Dragon, Boeing CST-100, and so forth. Then we have underneath that would be the suborbital spaceflight activities in that sliver that I talked about. That's around 800 million. Now, what I'm talking about with the orbital piece, that isn't the government spending on these programs, which is in which is fairly substantial. The 800 we're talking about here is revenue generated.
Okay.
So
suborbital
is pretty small. It's about around 13 million or so. Again, these are revenues generated from these companies in various ways. But one thing you will note is the caveat is that there has actually been no flights conducted yet for profit, including human beings in a sort of dedicated in a dedicated mission. So where those $800 million comes from is things like tickets sold through Space Adventures, as an example. Tickets sold that are in holding. So, for instance, you can put a deposit down on a ticket that's counted as revenue and waiting for their flight to come up. And that's where we come to today, which is the unveiling of the Virgin spaceship Unity. And that's the second vehicle after the Spaceship Two VSS Enterprise, which was lost in an accident in 2014, late 2014. So that's pretty exciting. The vehicle appears to be somewhat different based on its horizontal stabilizer. So there have been some changes in there. The vehicle is going to undergo flight tests now, probably in a similar way as the VSS Enterprise, in the sense that it'll do taxi tests, captive tests on White Knight 2, the carrier airplane. Then it will do some glide tests, and then, of course, it'll do powered tests. That's what we expect will happen in 2016, the full duration of the year. It is unclear how many of those tests would take place. They will take place under powered flights will take place under an FAA experimental permit, and that permit is issued for a duration of 1 year. So the tests will occur during, can occur as many times as you need them to occur within a year period. And then when you're ready to start sending folks up there for profit, that has to be done under an FAA license, an operator's license. You can't send people up in your vehicle with an experimental permit. You require a license to do that if you're based in the United States. So that'll probably happen, just taking a guess, around the early part of 2017. Thus would begin, presumably, the commercial human suborbital spaceflight and kick off that market. We looked at that market on a study. When I say we, I'm talking about the Torrey Group. We looked at that for a client, the FAA in Space Florida, the government branch in the state of Florida that works on attracting aerospace business to the state. And we looked at it from the standpoint of, once this first flight, first several flights kick off, you know, what would that look like over the next 10 years? As opposed to, it's going to start on this particular year and then evolve like this. There were too many forecasts that started on a particular year, and what that ended up doing is it kind of confused the issue. People were getting hung up on the start year and not on the actual way that this market might evolve over, say, 10 years. So once you start on year one, the baseline scenario gets you out to about $1 billion to $2 billion over the course of a 10-year period. That's a pretty good amount of money. And the point of it is, for some of these companies, and when I talk about this, I'm talking about Virgin Galactic and X-Core Aerospace, is to develop enough of funding to do other things. One of them would be orbital spaceflight. You know, you take the profits from the suborbital to invest into an orbital system to do routine cargo and passenger flights to points like the International Space Station, or, as an example, a Bigelow Space Station or something like that. Or in X-Core's version is to continue to do suborbital test flights for things like basic and applied research, education payloads, and things like that. When we did the analysis, by the way, the commercial human spaceflight rose to the top as the largest segment of suborbital spaceflight during the 10-year period. The next one was basic and applied research. And then the other ones, things like education, remote sensing, media and public relations, those kind of things, were kind of tiny. So that's kind of a long answer to your question. Hopefully that gets to it.
So you're saying the potential for the spaceflight with people is greater than the research suborbital spaceflight that we hear a lot about is going to be valued at. So you think the people part is going to be a lot more valuable?
Yes, indeed so. At least that's what our analysis said. And the analysis was different in the sense of different from previous studies, in the sense that it focused on the demand side of things. So we reached out to actual market segments and presumed users of suborbital vehicle systems and similar. And we tried to get at, you know, what the demand would actually be, as opposed to going to the suborbital providers themselves and asking them what they expected it to be, which would be more of a supply-based forecast. So the demand-based forecast is a little bit more vigorous. It's very complicated because you have to take the data and run it through some significant analysis and put it into context, because you have things for commercial human spaceflight, for example. What do you count exactly? Do you count flights or do you count seats like the airline industry does? If you count seats, you have to figure out a way to make sure that makes sense. So we came up with seats and or cargo equivalents, because now you also encounter the problem of how do you count payloads that are not human beings. So you can see where this goes. It's a considerable amount of work. And what comes out of that is the human spaceflight piece of it is by far the largest component. Then the question becomes, is it a sustainable industry? Is it a sustainable market? Will there be people buying tickets to go into suborbital trajectories over the very long term? A lot of people think yes, and some think no. I think the holy grail is for this to lead into point-to-point transportation with a single-stage-to-orbit vehicle, the kind of Concorde-like flight pattern, flight path where you would go from one point to another point halfway around the world in 2 hours or something like that. So that's one long-term potential vision of commercial human spaceflight, where these suborbital kind of up-and-down type things would lead to. Still, though, the up-and-down type things do have a potential application for basic and applied research because of the turnaround time. And because the vehicle is reusable, the cost for sending up experiments for between 3 and 5 minutes of microgravity could be lucrative, you know, and you can then send your items up into space, for example, to flight qualify them, and then when you bring them back, you can say that your product has been space tested, and presumably you could do that for a cheaper launch price than you could if you got a sounding rocket, for example, which is another option available to people today. In fact, you don't have to wait for a reusable vehicle. You can get a Chariot or Orion or a Up Aerospace out in New Mexico operates the Space Loft vehicle, which is extremely reliable. So there are, and then of course you have the microgravity aircraft, sort of the vomit comets, if you will, and you can put your experiments on there. The difference, though, with that is that it wouldn't be, in fact, space qualified in that classic sense. It wouldn't have been in the space environment, if you will.
Are you hearing any kind of strange noise on your phone line? Because we're hearing some kind of rhythmic clicking when you're talking. I don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah, I apologize. No, I don't hear anything on my end.
Because it comes from when you're talking. Maybe during the break I'll try to call you on a different line.
Okay.
And see if we can get rid of it. Does your research at all attempt to analyze the potential on a company-by-company basis, like Virgin versus X-Corp versus Blue or something like that?
No, we specifically didn't do that, sort of pick winners, if you will. But it's clear that Virgin Galactic has a fairly large number of tickets that are on reserve. You know, people have reserved their spots on the vehicle. So that would be, I believe, around 700 tickets have been sold, and each ticket is about $250,000. So you can get a sense of already, and that contributes, by the way, to the revenue totals that I mentioned earlier, that $800 million sliver of commercial human spaceflight. And that's for the snapshot of 2014 or so. So that's also something to keep in mind, not a cumulative value. X-Corp, their vehicle is smaller, and their focus is more on scientific payloads with payload specialists. So the vehicle will carry two people as opposed to the Virgin Galactic vehicle, which will carry six people plus a crew of two. The X-Corp vehicle will have a pilot and then a sort of payload specialist with payload. So there, and that's a single stage to suborbital as opposed to the Virgin Galactic, which is a two-stage system. So they're different enough to where it would be very difficult to try to isolate how that will split up. One way you might be able to look at it is commercial human spaceflight would be dominated perhaps by Virgin Galactic, and then the basic and applied research could be dominated by X-Corp Aerospace, but that would be completely conjecture.
Okay, you have a caller waiting on hold. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, Phil. This is Doug from Southern California.
Go ahead, Doug.
Phil, I'm just not sure I heard this, but does your $1-2 billion estimate for, I think, 10 years for, what is it, commercial HSF flight, I guess suborbital flights, did you take into account the possible, as I guess probable, increase in the market size with lowering of ticket prices in the future?
Yes, actually we did. And that was a calculated value. And in fact, it's good you bring that up because I think it was about $1.6 billion over 10 years once the industry starts to kick off. And, that is what we would call a growth estimate. So that's if things go really, really well. The baseline was quite a bit less than that, in fact, around $600 million over the 10-year period. So now you're talking about not extremely impressive numbers, and then the constraint was quite a bit less than that even so. So when we do a forecast, sometimes we look at a baseline, and then that's our best guess, educated guess, I would say, because a good deal of analysis goes into that. But then we factor in the potential for growth or the potential for things to not go especially well. That's where we start to look at ticket price variations, and the growth scenario included a very significant growth in the number of seats seat equivalent, cargo equivalents, or when I say cargo equivalents, by the way, I'm thinking we use the cargo module or drawer that's used in the that was used in the forward bulkhead of the space shuttle's orbiters. So if it gives you a kind of a sense of what we're talking about there. So kind of like a little locker. So anyway, that's what we looked at was adjustments in price, demand changes, and so forth. So it's not a huge market, but the revenues that would come from such a thing are presumably going to be used in investment for new systems, some of which might be orbital in nature.
Yeah, that sort of answers my next question: is how did you estimate, I guess, the market elasticity with lowering prices? Did you look at historical models of, like, I know the airline industry and the increase in flights and size of the industry with decreasing ticket prices?
So yes, among other sources. And that part of it, actually, I wasn't involved with in great detail, but that was definitely an analog that we looked at. There is a danger, of course, in looking at analogs of, you know, previous and existing markets and trying to apply them to space, because, as you know very well, we're talking about something quite a bit different. We did look, just to make a side note, we felt that the... you know, who would buy tickets that would cost $250,000? We needed to be a bit more realistic with the type of income level that somebody might have that would be interested in buying a ticket like that. And the $10 million mark of net assets and or wealth, if you will, was, we felt, more realistic than just saying people that have at least $1 million, for example. $250,000 is a significant sum of money, and it's not necessarily what one might call an investment, like a house is, or something like that, or other property. So we upped the ante on that a little bit to get a more realistic cut of the type of folks that might be interested in that, and that was supported through a survey process. But as far as the ticket, the tickets and how they might evolve over time, we did look at analogs. But as far as the calculation and so forth, I wouldn't be able to get into detail on that because I simply didn't work on that angle. But, you know, if you get through email through me, I'll be happy to give you some more detail on that.
Okay, yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah, David, it seems like when he's talking about once a second, there's sort of a scratch sound.
Yeah, in rhythm.
Yeah, in rhythm
with his talking. I have no idea what it is.
Does this help if I use the receiver?
Yeah, it does sound better.
Uh-huh. Okay, we'll go from there.
Okay, maybe that's what it was. Okay.
Yeah, I think that.
Oh, fantastic.
Okay.
Always good when you can make fix technology.
That's right, with a push of a button. anything else, Doug?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Doug, by the way, the report is available on our website if you wanted to just download it. And
what's the name of the report?
Let's see if I've got it here. I do. It's Suborbital Reusable Vehicles, a 10-year forecast of market demand.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you much.
Thank you
very
much.
Sure thing.
Okay, bye-bye.
In keeping with Doug's question, do you assess, or do you do anything with probabilities, but do you assess the probability of these companies actually lowering their prices, and by what degree? Because they've all got venture capital type of investors in them, and they all want return on investment that has been very slow in coming. So as they lower their prices, unless they're really picking up a lot of customers to make up the difference, they're going to see their ROIs decline. And are the venture partners going to be okay with that for them to have lower prices?
Yeah. So we do certainly internally discuss that, and it is part of the forecast process. But because it's a brand new market, it's very, very hard to, because one of the things we need to do is always back up our assumptions.
Uh-huh.
And if we, when, so part of that involves, so it's okay, for example, to develop assumptions based on your experience in the industry. But you have to be very clear about what those assumptions are so that folks understand where you're coming from. The other way to do that is to find analogs. You know, how did other industries of a similar nature evolve over time, and is that applicable to what you're looking at here? The danger, of course, there is that you are potentially comparing apples with oranges, but it at least gives you a sense of where things are going. I will note, though, that we just released a report today, in fact, about venture capital. And it's kind of a big deal because in 2015, it was the most investment that occurred in startup space companies, which would include companies like the Virgin Galactic and X-Corp, for example. The investment that took place in 2015 was more than the previous 15 years combined. So there's a lot of activity going on rather over the past couple of years in startup space companies, but it is important to note that a good deal of that investment has not been in suborbital spaceflight. It has been in remote sensing in particular and other industries. But so there is a considerable amount of activity that's going on in terms of investment, but not necessarily in suborbital spaceflight. Having said that, though, there is activity there, and you know, the other thing is when things kicked off in 2004 with Spaceship One and the XPRIZE, people expected this to happen relatively quickly thereafter. There was no promise of such a thing happening, but a lot of folks were speaking about their perceptions of where the industry were going, and it was after a bit it became the next year it's going to happen, the next year is going to happen.
Yeah, 2 years away.
Yeah, and it's been kind of like that for a bit of time. But it is true when people who know a thing or two about the industry point out that it is very, very hard to do this kind of work and to do it in a regime where you have to think about safety and all the other aspects of spaceflight. And then it's harder still, much harder in fact, to go into the orbital regime. So it is very, very hard work in addition to being in markets that we are seeing simply emerging. The best that you can do is get all the data available to you, do rigorous analysis, and develop models. So we do develop models where you bring in the data and outcomes, some result, and that result in turn needs to be analyzed and studied. So that's kind of how it's sort of a process that we follow.
You have an email, and then I'm going to move to some other topics here. We'll spend our whole show on space tourism. So this is from you probably know this gentleman, David Blappy Guertin.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay, if I got his name right and didn't mispronounce it. So he says, I would like to hear how Phil thinks Blue Origin's sudden entry into the market with their two successful tests will affect Virgin's share of the suborbital market. Blue appears to have caught up where Virgin Galactic is or was with their test program. The Blue Origin system appears to be simpler and by some regards is compared to a two-vehicle plane-type system of Virgin Galactic. Also, Blue has said their system is scalable, so what kind of effect will Blue Origin have on SpaceX when they scale up their system to an orbital one?
Yeah, so that is an excellent point. So the big, and I appreciate the question, the big three, if you want to put it this way, for suborbital spaceflight would be the two aforementioned, Virgin Galactic and X-Square Aerospace, but the other one is Blue Origin. Blue Origin, unlike Virgin Galactic in particular, and more like X-Core, but it's kind of its own approach, has been very secretive, very close hold on its technology and its development process. So we were aware, of course, a lot of people were aware of Blue Origin's activities for several years, but the nature of what they were doing in detail simply wasn't known. So last year, they flew twice, very impressive activity there. In fact, becoming the first company to launch a vehicle vertically, enter space, I believe it reached an altitude of about 101 kilometers. So 100 kilometers is what is called the von Karman line, and is generally accepted as the boundary between air and space, although it's certainly not a definitive boundary, but that is the agreed upon area for records handled by the International Aeronautical Federation, for example. And so that became the first vehicle to be launched vertically, enter space, and land vertically. Then what followed suit, just for listeners to be clear, is SpaceX in December succeeded in launching a vehicle into space at orbital velocities. So we're talking approaching 17,500 miles an hour, considerably faster than the New Shepard from Blue Origin. That thing went into effectively orbit, and then the first stage returned, was able to manipulate itself in hypersonic velocities and land on a pad, which is an extraordinary event. So both companies did really impressive technological feats. But it is an important question, what does this mean for suborbital spaceflight, getting back to the Blue Origin thing? It is very difficult, in fact, it is not possible to determine who's going to be a winner in this exchange, in this market. I think the hope is that, you know, you start to fly these vehicles, the New Shepard type vehicle, the Spaceship Two, and X-Core's Lynx, and it generates demand. The hope is, I suppose, that you're wrong with your baseline forecast in that it is actually a growth forecast. So it remains to be seen exactly how that's going to unfold. We did do the study in 2012. It would be a fantastic opportunity to look at that again see where things might be going from there. But now we're starting to see vehicles that actually work. So there are two things that are happening that are new than, say, 10, 15, actually more than 10 years, so 15 years ago. Maybe the late 90s is a good example. This was a kind of a bubble there as well. We are seeing hardware that is actually flying and doing very complicated things, and we're seeing a large amount of investment occurring, not just investment, but investment by non-space players, venture capitalists, angel investors that have not done the space thing before but are now. So we're seeing some differences that matter when we look at the future of spaceflight.
Interesting. The non-space investors that are starting to come into the scene, do you think that is sustainable, or can getting stuck in the doldrums and not doing much more turn that money away?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's very important to understand what's the inspiration behind the investment, and one of the big chunks of that has to do with what's sometimes described as big data. We're seeing a lot of companies that have emerged over the past several years. Probably the more famous of those has been Planet Labs and Google Skybox, and there are many others. But these companies are data companies, in the type of data they want to gather about the Earth in order to do what they want to do, they require satellites because that's the best way to observe the Earth's surface or, in some cases, the atmosphere. And then all of that data comes streaming down, and I guess you, me, and most other people could theoretically get an image from these satellites, But in and of itself, the image is not so important. You don't just hang it up on your wall. You need data, and you need the data to be digestible, and you need the data to be presented to you in a manner that is useful. So these companies are not just satellite companies. They're, in fact, data companies, and the satellites are incidental to their business plan. Having said that, though, you have to invest in the satellites, and you have to launch them, so a good deal of your capital has to be spent on that. A good deal of your money has to be spent on that. So once you get the assets in space, then you can start to bring the data down in there. And that is attractive to investors. Google, for instance, invested a considerable sum on Skybox a few years ago because of that. The data is what's important.
So switching then, in order for these companies to get their data down, and most are launching CubeSats or SmallSats of some sort, They need rides to space, and they need an affordable launch industry that has frequent flights. So mostly, you know, they're getting free rides or low-cost rides as secondary payloads.
Right.
So how do you see the launch industry in the United States? I'm not talking about, you know, foreign launch industry, but maybe you've included that in your research. How are you seeing it changing to meet these needs, but also to meet big satellite and other needs like SpaceX's Falcon series of rockets?
Yeah, so in terms of orbital launches worldwide, it fluctuates between about 60 and 90 launches a year. The biggest pattern that you see if you look back to the day of when Sputnik was launched in 1957 is that there was a hump during the Cold War, and then after the Soviet Union collapsed, the number drops off a little bit. And we get about, like last year, we had 86 orbital launches. So that's kind of gives you a big picture view of a sense of how much activity is going on in terms of orbital space flight. And then you have, then you sort of see what the demand is, what's generating those launches. A good deal of that is generated by government launches, which is somewhat predictable. You know, you have your image intelligence satellites and your government telecom satellites and so forth, and those are fairly predictable. And then you have the commercial side of things, the things that are launched because demand warrants their launching. For revenue generating, the biggest chunk is by satellites launched to geosynchronous orbit, about 35,000 kilometers in altitude, along the equator, the equatorial plane of the Earth, for example. That's prime real estate. So about $100 billion a year is generated from that orbit alone in television services. So that gives you kind of an idea there. The number of those satellites that's launched every year is about 20, and those are big satellites. They can get upwards around 6,000 kilograms or so, and so you would have a dedicated launch to that orbit. You require a good deal of energy to get to that orbit. One of the reasons they tend to be launched from equatorial spots. And then there are the non-geo satellites, and those things are, you might have heard of OneWeb. Recently, there are many other companies. O3b. There are companies that have been around a while, like Iridium, Orbcom, and so forth. And their satellites are in lower orbits, but because they're lower, you need more satellites in order to cover the Earth. Because the beauty of geo is that you need maybe three satellites, and you have complete coverage of the Earth without the poles. That is, but. So the beauty of these non-geo satellites is that, well, okay, I need a lot of them. Oh, if I'm a launch provider, that sounds really good to me. The trade-off, though, is that a lot of these satellites can be smaller, so you can pack a whole lot of them into one launch. So you may not, in fact, generate a great deal more launches. So when Iridium went up, there were about 72 satellites in the first constellation. You could cluster about 10 of these together on a variety of different launch vehicles. In fact, China launched a few of them in the late 90s. So up they would go, and then you have to replenish them. To get a sense of what we're talking about in terms of new vehicles and existing vehicles, you have 86 orbital launches. I recently did a tally of currently operating vehicles, currently available vehicles, and those that are currently under development. So a little bit beyond just paper rockets, if you want to call it that. And you're talking about 60 vehicles, not including the variants. So if you have an Atlas V, you can have several variants of that. Not counting those variants, there are about 60 vehicles out there.
Is that worldwide or the United
States? That's worldwide.
Okay.
Yeah. So that gives you a sense of kind of, is there a glut of vehicles? Are there too many vehicles? Because we're not quite seeing necessarily the demand there to generate more launch activity. The wild cards are things like commercial human spaceflight, commercial cargo to the space station. You know, are there markets that that capability will enable? Another wild card are these small satellite constellations. And here's why that's important. The technology so there's like a four-phase way that a company will deploy its assets into space, if you want to put it that way. The first one is technology demonstration. You know, I have this idea, I want to put it into a satellite, and I want to launch it to see if it works. And then when I determine what's going on with that, I can elaborate on a generation or two, and then maybe I can attract investors, get my constellation up, and then off we go. The tech demo, these companies we have found are willing to pay a premium to launch those satellites, which tend to be CubeSats nowadays, because you can pack a considerable amount of capability in a CubeSat, which is a 10-centimeter cube, thanks to Moore's Law. You can pack this stuff in there and send it on up. And they're willing to pay a premium for a dedicated launch in a predictable schedule, because if you are on a piggyback, as you mentioned, David, earlier, if you're on a piggyback, you're at the mercy of the primary payload or the big guy that's generating that launch. And so if that big guy says, you know what, I'm going to launch next year, or due to a delay, the launch vehicle provider is just going to reschedule, you're at the mercy of that. So already with the tech demo and this idea that you're going to pay a premium, we see an emergence of these very small launch vehicles coming around the corner. Some of the more well-known that have been in the press lately are Rocket Lab, Firefly. There's a bunch of them. Even X-Core Aerospace's Lynx 3 is going to have this capability as well. And we're talking about small payload capacities between typically, the small end, it's about 5 kilograms, all the way up to around the 200 to 400 kilogram range. Virgin Galactic has a Launcher 1, for example. So that's technology demonstration, and now you have the second and third phases, which are constellation deployment and constellation replenishment. Now you're talking about a bunch of satellites, a large number in some cases. That's when you would go buy a larger vehicle, that sort of pack a Soyuz from Russia or Europe with, you know, 50 of these satellites and launch them all at once. And then once that's deployed, you may occasionally need to replace the satellite, which is the fourth phase, and that satellite replacement may require a dedicated launch, which now is back to the small vehicle. So we're seeing maybe we will need all of these types of vehicles. The question is, who's going to survive of the, you know, 15 or so proposed miniature launch vehicles? Which ones will survive? Because the demand is such, as we can currently see, that it won't support that many vehicles by far. So that's kind of what we're looking at there. There's a lot of things going on out there, much more so than 10 years ago, and that's super exciting. But there are many unknowns as well, and you have to really study what those unknowns are and what they might mean.
Do you attempt to pick winners in this industry, like of the industry players? Do you have an idea of who's not going to survive?
Only internally. And if we're asked to do that by a client, we absolutely will do that. But that remains proprietary for obvious reasons.
Before we take a break, I have an email from George, who is up there in your neck of the woods in Boston. I guess that's in your neck of the woods.
Great town.
More so than in California's neck of the woods. Anyway, George says, with all of these reports that you issue, your analysis, your assumption making, have you ever done an evaluation of the accuracy of your end completed product over 10 years, looking at all of the different reports in industries you've reported on? How do you do?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. So the answer is yes. So we do it. There have been two examples that I can look at right away off the top of my head. One of them, we looked at an interesting study sponsored by the Air Force, where we looked at forecasts that have been done for technologies going all the way back to some cases I think we looked around the 1920s or so. So when you took a technology and you forecasted where that might go, we looked at all of those reports, and there were hundreds of these things that we ginned up. So one famous one would be fusion. We've heard about fusion power for decades. You know, oh, it's just around the corner. Give it 10 years, whatever you want to say.
Yeah, it's so like space tourism, uh-huh.
Yeah, exactly. So we looked at all of these different forecasts to see how accurate they were. And in many cases, they were projecting a opening year. So it's a relatively straightforward process. Look, in 1933, they forecasted that this was going to happen around the 1950s or so. Were they right? And so we did a bunch of analysis there. And in the end, it turns out that there were, and I forget exactly what type of forecasting was most accurate, but that helped us to understand what types of forecasting tools that we can use. Having said that, though, we have to apply those types of methodologies appropriately. You don't just take, oh, that works really well for technology, and just simply use that. Each situation with customers is we treat them in a very customized way because the questions are detailed and so forth. The other example that I can give you is we support the FAA Office of Commercial Space Transportation and the Commercial Space Transportation Advisory Committee, or COMSTAC. And COMSTAC is a supporting group of professionals in the space transportation industry that helps advise the FAA on matters relating to regulation and so forth. And they meet twice a year publicly, as a matter of fact. The public is welcome to come to these meetings. And there is a forecast that's generated each year to do that. And the forecast is divided between satellites launched to geosynchronous orbit and then the non-geo markets. So that would be remote sensing, non-geo telecom, commercial crew and cargo, for example, to the space station, and then everything else, and we kind of look at that. Each time we do that, we analyze how accurate the forecast is. What is hard is that these are supply-based forecasts, not demand-based, which means that we don't have the time or the resources to do demand-based forecasts on an annual basis because the amount of data that we would have to gather and analyze is huge. We would love to do that, but you have to sort of pay for that kind of analysis. So we do supply-based forecasts, which means that the nature of the forecasting means that the first couple of years in your forecast period, there's going to be a bump. There's going to be a bow wave, if you will. And so you're going to have a lot of companies saying, oh, we've got our satellites that they're going to go up on this particular year and so forth. And those don't happen. The best that we can do is tell the public, tell decision makers, these are what the companies are looking to put up there. We do some analysis to make sure that we're not just adding everybody who says they're going to launch something. So, for instance, we have a lot of remote sensing operators that want to launch small satellites. These have started to come out over the past, since about 2010 or so, when Skybox and Planet Labs started merging. We have hundreds of satellites that are being projected from all sorts of companies. And these would be launched between 2016 and 2018 or so. Which one of those are real? You know, that's an important question. The way that we do that right away is, do they have any money? Has there been any investment in these companies? If they have a little bit, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt and include them in the forecast. Do they have launch contracts? Do they have licenses from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration? Do they have FCC licenses? All of those things, if they check those boxes, then we include them in the forecast. But it is important to note that in those first couple of years, there will be a bow wave. And then, so as a result, the forecast will be generous, I guess you would say. But some of our customers want us to remove that and make a realistic forecast. Those type of forecasts tend to be proprietary, because that is where you start picking winners and losers.
How do you, getting any proprietary information, how does the Tory Group do in picking winners and losers for those customers that want it?
Very well. That is part of our reputation, is that we often end up saying things that maybe the customer doesn't want to hear. But in the sense that the customer wants to hear what we really think. That's what they hire us for. That answer may not be the kind of thing that you want to hear, in the sense that we hope that this thing will go gangbusters. We do the analysis as a third party. We have no stake in the game, if you will. And then the result may come back and say, you know what, we don't think there is, in fact, anything here. What they do with that information is up to them. So that's what I mean, is that they may not want to hear what we say. They do want to hear what we really believe, though, and what the data shows and what our models show and what our analysis shows. So in those cases, it goes really well. And I like that personally, because there, in the space industry, as you know very well, there is a lot of pie-in-the-sky stuff.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yes, there's a lot of that. And we here at Tory pride ourselves in being kind of idealistic realists, or realistic idealists. I don't quite know which one is the better descriptor. But so we are enthusiastic about space. We are here for a reason. We love the subject matter. But we bring a great deal of rigor to the analysis, because we want to give the right answer. We want to get to we want to know what's really happening out there, and that kind of culture is very good for me personally, as well as everybody else here. We care about it, we love it, but sometimes our colleagues get kind of annoyed with our somewhat non-optimistic views, perhaps, on how quickly things are going to unfold in terms of human spaceflight in particular, but other industries as well.
All right, listeners, we're going to take a pause for our break. We're a little past the halfway point on the show, and we will be back with our guest, Phil Smith, in about 3 minutes. The phone number, if you want to call, 1-866-687-7223, and email remains drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. Back in 3 minutes, everybody.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. We're in part two of our program with Bill Smith. It's Monday afternoon. This part of our program is brought to you by two additional sponsors. AIAA is one of our sponsors, and that is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They are the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have 30,000 individual members and 88 countries and 95 corporate members, and they shape the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology and increasing the knowledge of the universe and bringing the world closer together. Visit their website, www.aiaa.org. Go to some of their events, and they have five major events a year, which we'll talk about later. And you should become a member. There's a lot of ways to become a member, and their Aerospace America magazine is outstanding. And then Celestis, one of my very favorite companies, is a sponsor. Remember Dr. Gerard O'Neill, who we talk about all the time on the Space Show, because many of you talk about O'Neillian colony, was in many ways the father of the modern new space and commercial space movement. He was a Princeton physics professor who sparked a revolution by asking his students back in 1969 the simple question, is a planetary surface the right location for an expanding technological civilization? Later, he served on President Reagan's National Commission on Space. He inspired pro-space leaders and movements around the world, including the founders of Celestis, and they honored him when they included his remains aboard the Celestis Founders Flight, which was the world's first memorial space flight back in 1997. Visit their website, Celestis, C-E-L-E-S-T-I-S .org. And it's a great way to pay tribute to somebody. And as I said, Phil Smith is our guest today from the Torrey Group. I'll lead off, Phil, with an email from Dr. Doug in Southern California, who is the same Doug who called us during the first segment. These formal analyses tend to be used for industries in the marketplace. However, when we space advocates look to the future, we often recognize that some of the progress will be based upon government funding, which generally has nothing to do with commercial market demand or the perspective of investors, such as venture capitalists. Can you discuss how some of these formal analysis approaches could apply to the government-funded programs, including public-private programs?
Oh, actually, yes. It was funny because as the question unfolded, that's exactly what I was thinking about, were the public-private partnership arrangements. What's interesting to note is the PPP, as that is often called, was kind of frowned upon 10 years ago, say. But things have changed when it comes to a successful model, which is the commercial crew and cargo effort that NASA has been spearheading over the past since about 2008 or so. That has been very successful, a very good example of how the government can work to with industry to produce a capability that it requires in order to alleviate funding that it depends on each year to go out and beyond. So the idea here was we needed cargo for the space station, we're going to invest in a capability with the understanding that that capability will be sustainable and that NASA will not be required to keep that that business model going. That remains to be proven, but by all measures thus far, it looks like it's a pretty promising thing that's going on there. And then we'll see what happens with crew. It's a little too early to tell, but the idea here is to service the space station while NASA moves beyond low Earth orbit with the Space Launch System, which is a very capable vehicle in terms of its capacity to lift payloads into low Earth orbit and beyond, and the Orion space vehicle. So they want to go beyond. In order to do that, they need to be able to hand off cargo and passenger services to the space station. So that's that business model is so far considered to be successful. One way to prove that is that in 2010, I believe it was 2010, there was only one, actually I think it was 2011, now that I think about it a bit more, there was only one FAA license launch occurring from the U.S., and I believe that that might have been a Zenit, in fact, yeah, a sea launch vehicle. In any case, why I bring that up is an FAA license launch is typically one or two things. It either has to be licensed because the government agency went through a licensing process, like is sometimes the case when NOAA launches a satellite on a U.S. vehicle, or it was an internationally competed launch. If it's an internationally competed launch, that's considered commercial, that a customer shopped around for a launch and made a decision based on a variety of parameters and picked one. There was only one such launch in 2011. That number ballooned to about 12 in 2014. The bulk of that was SpaceX Falcon 9. So, and they have a backlog, I believe, of about 50 launches. I mean, it's a pretty impressive backlog. So that tells you that there's demand out there that they want to address. And, in fact, in 2015, things were going pretty well. I think they had about six launches before they had a failure. And that happens in the industry. But that was their 20th launch. So that was fairly impressive. They did 19 flawless launches. And then the 20th one experienced a failure. And I believe the Dragon was functioning properly but could not be salvaged based on the software package that was on board the capsule. So, you know, so in any case, it happens. But what we have seen is that investment in that company allows NASA to have the cargo capacity that ISS operations, and then that new vehicle is designed in such a way to keep launch prices lower. That's kind of the objective, is to make a launch vehicle that doesn't cost as much, and then presumably customers will start to gravitate toward that. But here's the caveat. It's not just price that matters. It's reliability that matters. It's customer service. It's a variety of other app capabilities. And United Launch Alliance, which provides the Atlas V and the Delta IV, has been doing a flawless job, frankly, since 2002. And they've launched, I don't remember the number right off the top of my head, but I think it's over 50 Atlas Vs and somewhere on the order of 30-some Delta Fours. And I could have that number wrong, but the point is those launches have been flawless. However, it is notable, and it's on the record, that these launch vehicles are very expensive. So, you know, what you're talking about is a commercial pie. So people who shop around for launches, there's a pie there, and there are competitors. And, you know, who are these competitors, and how is that pie changing over time? Basically, you have Europe in the form of Arianespace. Arianespace is also extremely reliable. They have the Ariane 5, big vehicle. They have a Soyuz, a medium vehicle, and the Vega, the small vehicle. And they've been very successful in terms of commercial launches since they started launching, I believe, in 1980, if I recall correctly. And then Russia has been pretty dominant, frankly, up until recently, which is an interesting note. They've been providing, when I say Russia, I'm talking about International Launch Services, IFC Cosmocross that provides a medium vehicle called the Dnipro. There's a variety of vehicles available to customers in Russia. Those are attractive because of the lower launch costs right away. And then you have the U.S. And the U.S., for a while, as I pointed out earlier, had a pretty tiny sliver because the United Launch Alliance didn't really worry about the international commercial market because they had a pretty good customer here in the form of the U.S. government. It was enough business there to keep going. Things are changing, as we're aware, and the U.S. pie has expanded. It has cut into, we believe, the Russian pie, because simultaneous to SpaceX coming online with a reliable vehicle, we also see Russia's vehicle starting to become unreliable in the form of the Proton in particular, and sometimes the Soyuz. And these were workhorses of the industry. But because of a variety of issues, these vehicles have become less reliable. So customers are starting to look toward SpaceX and so forth. How the Falcon Heavy factors in there remains to be seen. They have a few contracts signed. Viasat is one of them. But we did see Viasat move on to a different provider, Arianespace, because of the schedule delays. The Falcon Heavy was expected to be launched a few years ago. But again, it's hard work. It's not easy to do what they're trying to do. And it is paying off. The vehicles have, as we saw with that spectacular landing of the first stage in December of 2015, it's an impressive amount of work that's going on there. And they didn't just get close, they nailed it. So it's kind of impressive. But we have a launch coming up, I believe, on Wednesday of SES-9. You know, it's steady as she goes, one step at a time, and let's see what happens. But there is a change in the way the market is unfolding, and it's looking good for the U.S. launch providers as it stands today.
Changing pace a little bit, Amanda is in Sacramento, and she has a question for you on policy. And she says, we're in an election year. From your experience and your studying the history of space policy and what actually gets done with space policy, do presidential politics and the aftermath with an administration really influence what happens with space policy that much?
And it depends on the type of president that comes into the White House. I think that's fairly clear based on the way things change from the Bush administration to the Obama administration. And what I'm talking about there, of course, is what is the future for NASA? Where are they going to go in terms of human spaceflight? We had the Constellation program under Bush, for example. President Obama gets elected, and then things change. Now, those changes were based on committee reports, which were pretty detailed, and folks that were on those, I'm thinking of the Augustine Commission, for example, folks on those commissions and committees are very smart, and they know a thing or two. And these recommendations either get adopted or they don't. And under the Obama administration, they were. But what happens is that you have to also be realistic. There's an annual budget cycle. There's also continuing resolutions and other problems that have cropped up during the past few years that make the budget very unpredictable. Even the budget cycle, not just the amount of monies that we're talking about, but the budget cycle is very unpredictable. That is a very difficult environment within which to work. What has come out of that today is NASA's Journey to Mars initiative for human spaceflight, as an example. The way they have set this up, and it took a considerable amount of work to make this work, is to agree that in the future, at some point, probably the 2030s, we will put people on Mars. In order to do that, we need to do it in a three-phase process. And it includes the near-Earth or Earth-dependent section. Then there comes the proving ground or the sort of the cislunar space area, and then the Earth-independent part of it, which is where we actually have the operations and activity on Mars. That piece is fairly solid. The ways to go through and make those the elements and the structure and the architecture unfold will be a moving process that has to evolve as budgets allow and so forth and so on. But it's arranged in such a manner that we can get to Mars by making decisions along the way to accommodate for budget realities. The two that have already gone ahead is the Space Launch System that I mentioned earlier and then Orion. But we already see in the press recently that the upper stage of the Space Launch System is a confounding problem. Because of this iterative process, there are complicated decisions that need to be made in order to know which step to go forward. And without getting into too much detail, suffice it to say, that does affect schedules, it does affect planning, and people get frustrated with that, understandably so. But it is very, very hard to do the kinds of things that NASA does, and it's very hard to do them on a budget that it has. The budget that was passed for this fiscal year is very good, but it's very hard. NASA has to do a lot of very complicated and impressive things with a fairly small budget. But I do think that when presidents get elected, that things do change, and we anticipate that such changes will probably occur.
Do we have a track record of electing presidents that are generally supportive of NASA, or have we elected presidents that would just as soon close it down?
I think we've had presidents that do support it. I've never heard of a president who wants to shut it down. Indeed, it is such a part of the American identity, starting with Apollo, with this idea of putting people on the moon, that you can, even though Apollo is kind of more accurately described, perhaps, imperative, as a sort of technological contest with a peer. But once you set that bar so high, doing anything less or not having a human spaceflight program at all would be perceived as the United States having given up on that particular area of technology and development. That's really unacceptable to a lot of Americans, and rightly so. But it is the detail that is complicated. You know, because a lot of these folks have much bigger problems on their plate to as we know well, watching the candidates do their thing. There are much bigger problems that we have to work out. So space ends up being kind of at the very bottom, if it's thought of at all. In fact, I don't think that space has even been mentioned hardly at all in any of the debates or political points. And that's understandable. But once they get in and things get sorted out, policies are discussed and decisions are made. But never have I heard, and I'm not on the inside, by the way, I'm in many ways an observer like a lot of people, I've never heard of a president wishing to shut down NASA or anything like that. But I will point out that as a docent at the Air and Space Museum, there was definitely a perception that NASA had closed its doors when the space shuttle was retired. I found that surprising because, you know, that's a piece of communication that needs to be handled fairly delicately, and apparently it wasn't. There were a lot of people, because NASA does so much more. And NASA is, in fact, working on a human spaceflight program. So it was really something that I took upon myself as a docent to change perceptions, you know, that there's a lot going on here, and especially if they have kids that might want to pick a role in education and a career down the line, they need to know that there's stuff going on, especially when it comes to technology, engineering, and the arts. There's a lot going on.
So when you're talking to people at the museum now, do they still have a perception that NASA has gone into hibernation because of the lack of the shuttle, or has that changed?
I think that perception still remains, you know, that the U.S. is somehow behind in some particular thing. Now, this is kind of like an artifact or an echo of a different era that seems to constantly find its way into people's minds, this idea of the Apollo and the United States leading the way in space and so forth. And for human spaceflight, it's very, very hard, and programs that don't overlap cleanly and so forth. But it is notable that in 2015, the New Horizons vehicle spacecraft flew by Pluto, making the United States the first country to reach every one of the 9 original planets. That's significant. That's huge. And I think people were super excited by that, just like they were when Mars Curiosity landed on Mars. I mean, these things are significant. People note them, but they come and go in this sort of social media age. there's only a window of opportunity there, and then it disappears into the noise very quickly. But SpaceX and other companies, Orbital ATK, ULA, and on it goes, you know, they have business to do, and business is complicated, but it's happening, and they've got to carry out their launches, and they're doing that, and they're building hardware. Some of the most exciting things that I do are visiting factories and seeing people doing things. It's super exciting. Whether they're established players like Boeing or whether they're new players like Skybox Imaging. It's a big deal. A lot going on.
Sandra's in Seattle, and she sent in a note, David, I'm at work. Here's my question. I have often gone to the Science Fiction Museum, and I have heard, and I know that you've talked about this on the Space Show before, that some of the school kids coming through the museum are actually disappointed with the reality-based space exhibits because what they see in the movies, on television, and in science fiction is a lot cooler. And they have an expectation that that's what space should be like, not the reality of it, like a NASA spacewalk, for example. Do you have anything like that as an experience with the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum?
Actually, no, I don't. People are pretty wowed by the... So, first of all, if it flies through the air and it goes into space, people are already halfway there. They're pretty intrigued by that because it's something that's basically outside their experience. The interesting thing is they often fly as passengers on airliners and think nothing of it because I think it's so routine today that it's seen as kind of going on a bus. So there's still excitement when they see the Concorde, for example, and realize the thing flew across the Atlantic in 4 hours. There's a lot of excitement about fighter aircraft and these sorts of things, of course, because they're kind of unusual. The SR-71 is an excellent example.
Right.
And the space shuttle. So when they see these things, they really are wowed by it, especially if a human being has been involved in there. And the job of the docent is to really kind of make it matter. Because they look at this thing. I have to remember that I'm a space geek, and not a lot of people are, right? So you have to manage expectations, if you will. But the hope is, because Jules Verne, conceived of a pretty fantastical vision in 1865, from the Earth to the Moon. That book, clearly could not have happened in 1865, but it inspired, Hermann Oberth and Konstantin Tsiolkovsky and Wernher von Braun, and they made it happen, these people in varying ways. So people watching Star Wars, you see a fantastical thing. Avatar, I remember people were kind of disappointed walking out of the theater and thinking, geez, the Earth doesn't really compare to this. Yeah, but the Earth is real. Avatar is fake. And the idea is to take these artistic renderings and be inspired by them and make them happen or make some part of it happen. And that's the power of science fiction. It's a double-edged sword because it both inspires and in some ways it kind of deflates your bubble because you're thinking, oh, this will never happen or it's simply not possible. But you don't want to tell a kid that. You want them to take these forms of literature and other forms of arts, not just science fiction, and say that you can, how does that inspire you? How can that make you make this future you want possible? And you have to be realistic too. The warp speed thing. I mean, these are tropes to make the story move smoothly. You may not ever be possible to go faster than the speed of light. But as we saw with the gravity wave, discovery, who knows where that might lead? If you know a thing more in detail, presumably you might be able to manipulate it sometime in the future. Who knows? But I don't want to be the guy to tell the kid that's not possible. I want them to think outside the box, and the arts help for that, that creative impulse.
Is the space part at the museum a bigger draw for kids than the aviation part, or is it about equal?
I think it's a bigger draw. And that's an important question because then the question is why. And I think it's because space is pretty exotic. But it is different, I suspect, than when I was a kid in the 1970s and there were fewer astronauts out there. And I didn't know a whole lot about what the Soviets were doing. But that was the era when there were few astronauts in their silver outfits and black spaceships doing exotic and crazy things. The space shuttle, when it comes online, and it flew for 30 years, these vehicles, these five vehicles. During that 30 years, it effectively democratized the astronaut corps. You started having all sorts of different people going into space in the hundreds. And that changed the way we thought about astronauts, but not entirely so. So when I see an astronaut, I still get kind of giddy. You know, this person's been into space, you know. But the type of person that's done that, they're more numerous and they're more diverse. And so the next era, or whatever you want to call it, presumably, we're going to have even more people that have gone into space. And the irony is it'll probably start becoming rather mundane. Okay, so what? I went into space, you know, a couple of months ago. So maybe we're transitioning to a point where it becomes less exotic and strange and becomes more like a realm for, you know, a renaissance in blue-collar work or something like that, where I go to the moon because the six-figure salary is attractive, not because I love to go to the moon, but because I need a job and I need a good job. That's probably the holy grail. And how do you get there? I don't know. I know Elon Musk wants to make that future possible, and that's why he generates excitement, because he brashly thinks he can do that, and that's a good thing.
Did you see how many people applied for astronaut training?
Yeah, I think it was something on the order of 18,000.
Record numbers.
Yeah. And the neat thing is, that's USA jobs, right? So that's a U.S. government position. There are going to be other positions like Virgin Galactic, like SpaceX, like Blue Origin, and the list will go on. There will be more opportunities than going through the U.S. government. And it's going to be a little slow going there for a while, I think, but those are opportunities that are emerging.
If you were asked to place bets on the success of the emerging commercial space industry, would you place positive bets that you think it will end up being a successful industry 5-10 years out with multiple customers and all that makes an industry successful?
I do, but so I think in the long-term vision, I can definitely see in my loins, I can feel it, people living, working, and playing in outer space. I feel it. The rub, the difficulty is in how to make the leap from today into that reality. And it occurs to me that that reality will unfold over probably a few centuries, if not more. So, if that's the reality, what are we expecting over the next 5 to 10 years? And I think it'll be basically, and probably for the next several decades, we'll be focusing more on efficient access to outer space. How do we do that efficiently and cost effectively? How do we deploy telecommunications assets and data retrieval systems in outer space in a manner that's more efficient? And we stop thinking about space in an exotic way, but we start thinking about space as an environment within which we can expand our economic sphere of influence. And I think, you start thinking of the moon. So it's almost like when I do what's called space art. You know, if I do the horizon of the moon and then the Earth rising beyond it, that's often described as space art. But why isn't it called landscape painting? You know, it's a natural environment. It's not any different. It's just a different place in a natural environment. Stop thinking about space as an exotic place forbidden to people or beyond the means of the regular Joe. It's going to take a while. And so I think that these companies that we see now are working towards an era where we will have efficient access to outer space, but it has to inspire new demand, because the demand that exists today isn't enough to support all of these new companies that are coming online. So the hope is that these companies will come on board. So say, for example, you have a Dragon vehicle that has people in it. NASA's the only customer for that, but why it doesn't prevent a country from saying, you know, I'm going to rent a Dragon and I'm going to have my own space station up there. You've generated new demand there all of a sudden. We haven't seen that, at least publicly, but that's the hope. So I'm optimistic, but it's going to unfold over the very long term, I think.
Pamela in Tucson, Arizona. David, I'm also at work. Do you at all look at or try to evaluate the space settlement movement? I don't know if you call it more than a movement. What do you think about space settlement, and is it going to be a contributor to the space-based economy?
So We haven't been tasked from a practical standpoint, contracted or asked to evaluate anything of that nature. So in general, when you're talking about investors or companies that are generating revenue or government agencies that have their agendas to execute, there is nobody's approached us for that kind of analysis. Having said that, as I pointed out, there are people here in the company that think about these problems in some degree of detail. And one thing that constantly comes up is how do you sustain such activity? So there have been a variety of efforts, for example, to go to Mars. So the federal government through NASA has a way to look at that problem. Some commercial entities have also done this. It's well known, for example, that Elon Musk that's his main driver. That's what gets him up in the morning. In order to make that vision come true, he is a businessman, and he knows how to make money, and he also wants to make a difference. And so he puts these two together and realizes that in order to make that vision happen, I need to develop technologies and capabilities where there is demand. And launching satellites into orbit may not be sexy for a lot of people, but that's how you generate revenue, and then you take that piece and you put it and you invest it into something new. And they're investing it in a bigger rocket than Falcon Heavy, as it turns out, and the Falcon Heavy is pretty big. When that thing launches, it'll be able to carry 53,000 kilograms into low Earth orbit, which would make it the most powerful vehicle in the inventory today. But what is going to be, in other words, to cut this short, I don't want to see a Roanoke. I want to see a Jamestown, and I worry about a lot of the visions that have you putting people on Mars, and they underestimate not the technology. You can always find engineers to be able to develop a vehicle or a system or an architecture to get you there. This is not the issue. The issue is the money. It's the socioeconomic part of it. What is your crew complement? What is the religious makeup of you, the gender makeup, the skill set? All of those things seem to me to be somewhat dismissed, and they underestimate the psychology, the all those nuanced things that require you to have a successful mission to Mars. And then once you're there, how do you keep them alive? We don't know the Earth necessarily a tenth as well as we think we do. How is it that we can think that we can go to Mars and make that work? You're talking about billions and billions of dollars and lives. So it's a significant thing. We'll get there. Of this I have no doubt. But why do we have to worry about making it happen tomorrow? It's almost like a sailor going out into the sea and disrespecting the ocean. As soon as you do that, it will swallow you up. And outer space, I feel, is the same.
As I recall...
You have to respect it.
Yeah, as I recall, Jamestown didn't do very well, right?
It didn't do very well, but it was permanent.
Well, for how long?
Roanoke.
Well, yeah, I mean, it lasted...
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, Jamestown's a historical place, I guess you can... I've never been there, but I guess you can go to where Jamestown was, right?
Well, it's more like folks stayed in Jamestown. It was very hard living,
Yeah, indeed. Terrible.
And ultimately it disappeared.
Right.
Yeah, ultimately it disappeared. But it gave rise to other settlements throughout Virginia and elsewhere. So it was like a grappling hook on the summit. It got you there, and it was permanent.
And of course,
Roanoke, because they couldn't resupply it. They went away.
And there were Native Americans to help them, and I don't think there are any Native Martians that are going to share the tricks of the trade with Mars One people going there. I don't know, why do people want to? I mean, look, people are really in a hurry, and
they are.
Space cadets. How many times I hear on the space show, we were cheated out of Mars when we went to the moon. We should have been on Mars by now. We're entitled, and they really truly believe that had things unfolded differently after the Apollo program, we would have been on Mars, and we've been robbed of that experience. So as they get older, they want it now in their lifetime. They think we are ready to go. I've got a show coming up on Friday where the guy's talking about what's needed to create a Martian settlement today.
Yeah, I'm torn because I want people to think and dream and do these things, and I don't ever want to dissuade anybody from doing that. But one of the things that I recall is when I was in high school, I really disliked history classes. I just did not understand why I needed to sit through these dreary lectures and so forth. Now I love it. And the reason I love it is because, first of all, it's the greatest story ever told. And second of all, it provides a contextual framework within which I can think about the future. And you realize, especially if you expand your view to include all of human history, even the unwritten, so 200,000 years, say, and the bigness of space, the vastness of space. I mean, everything that we know over the past 10,000 years of written history took place on this little tiny planet. Believe that you're going to expand the human experience out beyond, Mars or beyond, within centuries is naive to the extreme. It is very hard, and it needs to be sustainable. And by the way, human beings were not designed to live in space. So there's a whole lot of stuff we do not understand, and we need to understand them. And I believe we will understand them, and that eventually we will live out there. And it bothers me that I don't believe that it will happen in my lifetime. I'm 46, and it bothers me because when I was a kid, I felt like this was going to be a thing. You know, I'll be going to Mars. It's a done deal. But then I learned what Apollo was, and it wasn't meant to be a step into the direction of Mars. The great Wernher von Braun thought it would be, but he realized that he could not sell it because it simply was too expensive. And, his master plan was to do that, and there's something sad in realizing that that couldn't happen in your lifetime. But look where he got us. He got us thinking about it. Astronauts went to the moon. That's significant. But the Mars thing, I think, if you were to ask me, is it going to happen in my lifetime, it won't. I believe that it won't. That my dreams and my aspirations for spaceflight, I'm afraid, going to rest not necessarily with my nephew, but his kids. And yeah, it does bother me, but there's also comfort in knowing that grasping reality and knowing that you can take a piece of that off and do good in that way. So maybe if I do paintings about our future in space, that's okay, because maybe I'll inspire some kid to make it happen. But and I'm okay with that.
I'll bet you think we might get humans to set footprints on Mars in your lifetime. Right.
I think that's possible. Yeah. Certainly possible. I think that's possible. Sure. But I do worry that it'll be a very Apollo-esque thing, and we spend $100 billion, we walk around on Mars, and then we learn a few things. And one of the things we learn is that we were too early. I'm more of a person that thinks the moon should be our primary focus, and cislunar space. I feel like we're going from the baby pool to the deep end, and not only that, but we're also going to try and dive off the high dive in a very elaborate and choreographed way. We need to think about this clearly. And by the way, I'm talking in part with government agendas. We need to figure out more precisely what we can do and what we should be doing. And the commercial sector should be free to do basically everything they need to do as long as it's, regulated and safe. So, for instance, if Elon Musk says, I've got a plan and I'm going to go execute it, as long as you do it within the confines of the law, then please prove me wrong because I want to be proven wrong. Desperately so.
I got a couple of emails I want to get in before we end the show. So Bijan is in Sweden.
Sure.
And you can maybe do this in a short fashion. Do you evaluate CubeSat?
Sure.
Do you evaluate CubeSats and secondary launch payloads? So we sort of have done this a little bit in the first segment of the show. But what else would you say about CubeSats and secondary launches?
likely, if it's even possible for me. I know it's sort of not, but the CubeSat thing started in 2003, and it basically stayed relatively low. That is to say, between 3 and 20 CubeSats would launch each year, secondary payloads through 2012, and largely they were education payloads. Beginning in 2013, we start to see a major expansion of the number of CubeSats going up. Most of those are 3U CubeSats, which is three CubeSats stuck together, essentially. And we saw 81 in 2013, and in 2014 it went to 130, and in 2015, 150 or so. So, and we're seeing a bunch more coming, and the bulk of those are commercial. And when I mean commercial, I mean Planet Labs, and Spire Global. Those are the two companies that are sending these things up for profit. So we're seeing a large number of those. I think they will be launched, by brokered, launch vehicles. We saw one, brokered by Spaceflight Industries, purchased a dedicated Falcon 9 launch from SpaceX for CubeSats and microsatellites. And that is a game changer. That's new. That's different. And there was another dedicated launch purchase recently that I can't get into in detail, but buying a dedicated large vehicle for tiny satellites is significant. Where is that going? In different directions, I think, but we definitely are starting to see small satellites for profit as well as education starting to go up with greater frequency, and we can expect that to continue.
Okay, and Doug sent in another question. He must be on a roll today down in Southern California. It must be the heat that's causing it. This is way down the line, but could you comment on whether you think there would be much public interest in retiring, whether on the moon or on Mars? Most people can't figure out a business plan for Mars, but it seems that Elon Musk is think about it primarily from the perspective of people selling their homes on Earth and moving to Mars. The people who have that sort of, I'll just read it the way it is because it doesn't make sense to me. The people who have that sort of wants would be older. I guess that sort of view would be older. I don't know. I mean, I think it's all foolish, but, you know, what the hell? I've been wrong before.
I mean, I don't think that would work. I think one of the ways to kind of get to it is to determine what kind of resources you have up there. So the moon is useful from the standpoint of real estate primarily. It's a place to set up shop. The good news is there isn't any life as far as we know there. So there is a certain ethical barrier that you can overcome. But, you know, what is the thing made of in great detail? How are these resources, integrated in the regolith and the bedrock and so forth? Really, really characterize, you know, there may be caverns in there. There's a lot we don't know about the moon, but it's a good place to start. There's a Lagrangian points, Bigelow, you know, the inflatable modules. These things are huge. There might be something to that, you know, where you develop a destination in orbit and then you build from there. Sporting events that take place in microgravity might be a very popular idea, especially if you could somehow link it with the Olympics or something as a demonstration sport. So I think these kind of things can really generate new ideas, but you got to kind of go step by step. And I know that is annoying. believe me, I'm like, why aren't we there yet? You know, where's my flying car kind of a thing? But you've got to go one step at a time. How does the car fly involved in there? What's the science? Maybe I'll just carve off a little piece of that and work my PhD around that. And then everybody contributes to the, I mean, it wasn't one person that developed the airplane. The Wright brothers didn't just conceive of this thing in their bicycle shop. There were many, many people, including women, that contributed to the idea of how to make an airplane before they even got to 1903. So it's you build on the shoulders and it's a team thing. And, going to Mars is so big a deal. It's almost inconceivable how it's going to work out, but I do believe it will.
And listeners, just before we end our show, just to let you know that there's another world out there other than the one we've been talking about, I am being contacted by a student, and I won't say any more than that because I don't have this person's permission to do what I'm about to do. So this person will remain anonymous, and I'm only going to read a very small portion of the email, but part of what it says is, but as for the 21st century, the new motives of going to space are to exploit, e.g. pillage the moon for its resources, explore via science and space tourism, and experience the overview of X sublime via space tourism. So there is a group out there, there are people out there who don't really appreciate or value what we see and what we want to do and what we think is important about going into space, and believe that we're pillaging the moon, and when we go to Mars, we'll probably do worse. And there's been a lot of posts on the Space Show blog lately that came up with the guest Hop from Hop's blog, where if anything was found on Mars that might be molecular or biological life, no matter how simple or basic or whatever it is, we shouldn't be on Mars at all. We should just leave it alone and not contaminate it with anything that humans do. So there is another world out there other than the one that we've been talking about today, and I think it's important to keep that in mind. So I
agree.
Do you ever run into this at the Smithsonian, people who object to what we do in space and things like that?
No, actually I don't, but I'm absolutely in agreement that it exists, and I think it's an important question, because we do live on Earth, and I find it to be the greatest planet that there is, and I'm constantly stunned by its beauty and so forth, but there's also the practical part of it, and I am part of the Earth. It's my home, and I want to take care of it, and we have major, major problems when it comes to taking care of the Earth, as well as how we live on it. But I do see outer space as a natural environment, and we are living things, and living things grow and they survive. And we may not be the ones that go out into space. You know, there's 5 billion years left in the Earth's lifespan. We may come and go, and something else will go in our stead. But I think it's a natural thing for life to go out there and all the problems that ensue. That shouldn't stop us. And, you know, I've heard this thing in a different way where, you know, we should spend money here on Earth instead of in space. You know, all that money we spend on space is spent on Earth. it's not spent in space.
Yeah, there's no bank on Mars.
It generates jobs.
Yeah, there's no lunar bank yet, or Martian bank where we can make a deposit. Absolutely.
But living cleaner and all of that, I think, is a notable point.
Pearls of wisdom or concluding comments that you would like to offer us today, or takeaways that we should hold on to for dear life?
Oh, I don't know. I guess if you're thinking about outer space and our future in space, it's always important to temper the enthusiasm with understand history of space flight, the history of why people do what they do, the cost issues, the investment issues, the psychological point. I mean, what is it like to have 12 people in a tin can going on their way to a one-stop mission to Mars and they can't see the Earth anymore? So there's a lot of hard stuff that's sometimes dismissed, and I just encourage people to realize that space is huge. It's massive. I'm saying the obvious, but it is not trivial, and you know, we'll get there, but you know, just temper the enthusiasm a little. It doesn't mean you can't dream, God knows.
Yeah, you want to keep dreaming. Absolutely, keep dreaming.
I agree.
Phil, I want to thank you for being with us today, and I look forward to talking to you again down the road. It's been a great discussion, and listeners, tomorrow is one of those few programs I open up for people who want to be a guest on the space show. This is your audition show, so if you really want to be a guest on the space show, call us up and tell us why, and we want to hear what you have to say and what you have to offer, and we always are looking for new people to be on the space show, so this is an opportunity for you. 7 to 9 p.m. California time tomorrow evening. Again, Phil, many thanks for being with us, and we look forward to talking down the road. Everybody have a great week ahead. keep looking up. And again, thanks to Phil Smith and all of you for participating. Goodbye from the space show.